Tuhu bila fasl. You can't separate there and have, you know, one, two, three in between. No. It is Rasul, and then bila fasl, immediately then the successor is Ali. First time after the wafat of Rasulullah, and this is again the early days of Khilafat, when the people accepted him as the Khalifa, he comes into the masjid and sits on the minbar of Rasulullah. These minbars are different. This is what we just call symbolically. But that was actually the minbar of Rasulullah, the real one. Amir al-Mu'minin goes there first time, goes into the minbar right away at the top. And this is where the Ummah is saying, oh, what is this? This is almost 24 years after wafat of Rasulullah. Look at the answer now. When now he is told why people are, you know, talking to one another, there is murmuring going on, you know, he responds. And his response is, سَمِعْتُ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ يَقُولُ. He says, I heard the Prophet saying, مَنْ قَامَ مَقَامِ. Whoever stands in my place, whoever takes my place, وَلَمْ يَعْمَلْ بِعَمَلِي, and doesn't act according to my sunnah and my actions, أَكَبَّهُ اللَّهُ فِي النَّارِ, Allah will throw him into the fire of Jahannam. وَعَنَا وَاللَّهِ, and by Allah, as far as I am concerned, الْعَامِلْ بِعَمَلِهِ, I act according to the actions of Rasulullah and his sunnah. الْمُمْتَصِلُ قَوْلُهُ, I implement his instructions and his sayings. الْحَاكِمُ بِحُكْمِهِ, and I give verdicts according to the judgment of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. فَلِذَٰلِكَ قُمْتُ هُنَا, therefore I am sitting and taking this place of Rasulullah.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human beings and we are looking at their rights. And there is no one better to tell us about the rights of human beings than the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salamullah. We began looking at the letter written by Amir al-Mu'mineen to his commander, Malik al-Ashtar, when he sent him as a governor to Egypt. Now, we are looking in this letter and we're trying to derive all the human right lessons and all the rules and regulations that need to be applied in humanity as a whole and in society for us to be a better people. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he's giving this letter to Malik, because Malik now is in a position of power, which means concepts like justice, concepts like freedom, poverty of people, the affairs of people, are all in the hands of the governor. People's right and their rights now are in the hands of their new governor. Now, how should a governor deal with his people? How should he maintain and provide his subjects and his people with their basic rights? So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, from here, he's trying to give him direct instructions of how to deal with people in terms of human rights. He says to him, develop in your heart the feeling of love for people, and it will be the source of kindness and blessings to them. Now, generally speaking, human beings, one of the main things that we have in our hearts that we interact with one another is based on love. Love itself and compassion and kindness, it's a moving factor to create a stable society and a stable community. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says that kind of love, first and foremost, has to begin from authority itself. when the people realize that their governor or the authority that rules them is showing love, showing them love, kindness, and mercy, it's obviously not through words, rather through actions. I mean, how do I know that the prime minister or the president or the mayor or the governor of my city loves me? Through his actions, because I can't get to him, I can't make a phone call and say to him, do you love me? I mean, it's nonsense. But when I see that he provides services for the city, he builds roads, he creates infrastructure, he helps try to eradicate poverty and ignorance and try to create education and healthcare and try to better the situation of people, then I do understand that this person has compassion, that human rights are being met. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he says to Malik, develop that love in your heart, where not just sit and say, well, I love my people. No, but show it to them in a form of actions. It means better their lives in a way that it is noticeable to them. So through that love, they can have love towards you as well by obviously being obedient to you. Let us take a break and then we come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were looking at how Amir al-Mu'mineen instructing his commander Malik al-Ashtar to make sure that human rights are observed. And then he says to him, do not behave with them like a barbarian and do not appropriate that to yourself. Now, so either a governor or a person in authority, he shows love towards the people, obviously by showing them actions, by building for them, by giving them their rights, education, healthcare, and all the things that we mentioned, or vice versa. You see that sometimes when governments take place, and not only they do not provide for people, but they deprive people. So for example, when a country or a system starts to create lots and lots of taxes, and they, for example, they bring up the rate of the currency high or the prices goes higher, then people suffer in return. They cannot live. They cannot maintain their livelihood. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says that's a barbarian act when your people are suffering, when they cannot, you know, meet their requirements, when they cannot provide for their families, when they cannot educate their kids, when they cannot cure their sick, then that's the barbarian act. And we can see this throughout the world right now, where there are governments which are barbarians in their nature, where people are suffering. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he says, power, authority, it needs to show love in action by giving the people and not becoming barbarians. And then the Imam alayhi salam, he says, look at it from this perspective, that people themselves are either brothers in faith or equivalent in humanity. They're human beings. What gives me the right to come and take the rights of others and usurp them and take their money, take their land? Because the kings and the rulers at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and even now governments, they come to people, either they tax them too much, they charge them too much taxes, or as some cases, they take their land, they take their property, they close down their factories, and which means that the essence of a humanity disappears. When I take the right of someone else, then there is no humanity left in me, because the person I'm dealing with, either he's a brother in my faith, we share the same faith, therefore I have to give him extra love and extra care, or at least I should look at him as another human being like me. In the same way I want to live, he wants to live. In the same way I want life to be easier for me and my kids, he wants his life to be easier for his kids. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he clearly highlights that fact. And that should be the point of a human rights itself, that dealing with people, you either look at them as brothers in faith, which means you're good to them, or you look at them as human beings, and you should still be good to them either way. So in no case should we start to deprive people of their rights. And sadly, this is something that we are currently facing, is that we have systems in play that looks at people as servants, as machines, to create wealth for them while they enjoy the good life, and the majority of the people suffer. And millions of people are dying due to poverty and what have you. That should not happen. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he brings that to his commander Malik al-Ashtar. Inshallah, we will continue looking at human rights in this letter in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
In the limelight.
Recently, scientists announced that the REACT study, which randomly tests about 150,000 people across England each month to see how many are infected with coronavirus, will be scrapped at the end of March, and no further data will be collected beyond that point. We now present you an article written by Linda Geddes under the heading, Pandemic is Not Over, Ministers Criticised for Scrapping UK COVID Surveillance. In Britain, ministers have been accused of turning off the headlights at the first sign of dawn after scrapping nationwide COVID surveillance programs, with scientists saying it will almost certainly end up costing more money in the long run. Recently, scientists announced that the REACT study, which randomly tests about 150,000 people across England each month to see how many are infected with coronavirus, will be scrapped at the end of March, and no further data will be collected beyond that point. Funding is also being withdrawn from the Zoe COVID symptom study, the Siren and Vivaldi studies, which monitor infections in health workers and care homes, and the COMIC social contact survey, while mass free testing is due to end on 1st of April. The Office for National Statistics, ONS's COVID infection survey, which regularly samples the same 180,000 people to estimate what percentage of the UK population is infected, will continue. It comes as growing numbers of new infections in multiple countries led one expert to prompt speculation that Europe could be at the start of a sixth wave of COVID infections, partly driven by the stealth BA2 Omicron variant. Dr. Stephen Griffin, a virologist at the University of Leeds in England, said The decisions on COVID surveillance would slow the country's ability to respond and adjust to future waves or surges of infection, making the current reliance on emergency booster programs progressively less viable, and were at best short-sighted. Dr. Stephen Griffin added, "At worst, it is symptomatic of a policy-driven movement to ignore the fact that the pandemic is not over and that we remain in a highly dynamic situation with respect to immunity versus infection and virus evolution. This is about as far from following the science as you can get," adding, "Losing these programs will almost certainly end up costing more in terms of disruption than saved. It is a false economy and yet another example of short-term thinking." Stephen Reicher, a psychologist at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, said the decisions made no sense on public safety or public health grounds. Stephen Reicher added, "It is like turning off the headlights at the first sign of dawn. You can't see what's coming, and you don't know when it makes sense to turn them on again." Recently, the government announced that its Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, would no longer regularly meet to discuss coronavirus. Stephen Reicher, who sat on the SAGE Behavioural Science Subcommittee, said the decision to stop funding these surveillance studies was far more significant than standing down SAGE. He said those scientists are still working and can reconvene quickly, but how can they work or know if they need to reconvene if the data isn't there? The ending of free mass testing on 1st of April could make the situation even worse. Dr. Kit Yates, a mathematical biologist at the University of Bath, said, "Boris Johnson's insistence that tests will be available for anybody to buy completely misses the point." Dr. Kit Yates added, "Many people in the United Kingdom will not be in the position to spend a significant portion of their budget on testing each week. Others will simply be put off by the cost of testing." Dr. Kit Yates added, "The consequence will be that testing drops significantly. People become less aware when they are infectious and consequently less able to take the personal responsibility that the government has been highlighting so vociferously in the aftermath of their removal of other COVID mitigations." According to the latest Office for National Statistics figures, the percentage of people estimated to have tested positive for coronavirus rose in England, Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland in the week ending 5th of March, while the percentage of infections compatible with the Omicron BA2 variant also increased across all countries. Austria, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany and many other European countries have also seen a sharp increase in daily confirmed cases since the start of March. Dr. Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute in Loyola, California, United States, said the uptick could mark the beginning of a sixth wave of COVID infections in Europe, driven by a combination of the BA1 and BA2 Omicron variants and the relaxation of restrictions in many countries. Dr. Eric Topol added, "There are definitive signs of a new wave starting throughout many countries in Europe, some of which are also showing increases in COVID hospitalizations. It is hard at this point to determine if the cause is reducing or eliminating restrictions, BA2's higher rate of transmission, or waning of immune protection from vaccines." Dr. Eric Topol added, Right now is the last time that countries like the United Kingdom and United States should be cutting funding or abandoning any surveillance and testing measures. As much as we all would like it to be, the pandemic is far from over. Meanwhile, France will lift most of its COVID restrictions in coming days, scrapping President Emmanuel Macron's flagship vaccine pass and ending compulsory indoor mask wearing in schools and many public spaces, as the government vows to ease pressure on French people's daily lives despite a rise in infections. Less than a month before April's presidential vote, the French government has brought forward its promise to ease restrictions before the summer. From Monday, 14th of March, school children aged 6 and over will not have to wear face masks inside classrooms for the first time since September of 2020. Face masks will no longer be mandatory in shops, public services or workplaces. But face masks will remain compulsory on all public transport, as well as at hospitals and for people visiting elderly loved ones in care homes. The Prime Minister, Jean Castex, conceded in an interview this weekend that there had been an upturn in cases like everywhere in Europe, but he said pressure on hospital emergency wards was going down and the BA2 variant of Omicron was more contagious but seemingly less dangerous. Prime Minister Jean Castex said, while the French government continued its strategy of easing restrictions, he strongly recommended people who are vulnerable because of their age or pathologies to keep wearing face masks in indoor spaces. The end of the vaccine pass means that for the first time since last summer, people no longer need to show a QR code to eat out in a restaurant, go to a cafe, work out at a gym, board a long-distance train, go to the cinema or borrow a book from library. President Macron first introduced a health pass in July of 2021, making it compulsory to have proof of either vaccination, recovery from COVID, or a negative test to enter places such as museums, restaurants and coffee shops. Although the policy led to some street protests throughout France, it had the support of the majority of the public in opinion polls and helped to push up vaccination levels. More than 1 million people made a vaccine appointment in the 24 hours after President Macron announced his first health pass last summer.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
Imam Khomeini's speech to seekers of knowledge. The path of Allah is that path where man in all his striving or determining of intelligence, average strivings, ideal strivings, strivings of place, practical strivings achieves guidance. If people remain on this right path, then they are for Allah. That path is the path of Allah. Whoever will be on this path will be for Allah, even so that every part of man, all of his actions, all of his movements all of his thoughts and all of his connections or links will be for Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that what makes hardships easy to bear is the fact that we tolerate them for the sake of Islam. Now, in this part of speech, he has clearly said that there are hardships in the life, and definitely we can see these hardships in all parts of the life, in all aspects of the life. No matter a person is Christian, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, or even if they are atheist, they have hardships. But the point is, these hardships are ease for some people, and these hardships are really hard to bear for the others. For those who think that it is easy to bear, it is because of Islam, especially when Imam Khomeini is saying, obviously we know that he was the leader of the Islamic revolution, and this revolution has given so many sacrifices, so it is not easy to tolerate all these things. These many people who lost their lives, and there were many people who had these hardships. Why they bear all these things? It was all for the sake of Islam. And those who do this, therefore, there is specific reward for them.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
In chapter 5, verse number 124, Allah says, وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِنَ الصَّالِحَاتِ مِنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى. And those who perform the good deeds from the men and women, وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ, and he is from the believers, from the Muslims. فَأُولَٰئِكَ, therefore, for them, يَدْخُلُونَ الْجَنَّةِ, therefore, they will enter the paradise, وَلَا يُظْلَمُونَ نَقِيرًا, and not they will be wronged. So there is a reward, and the reward is entering to the paradise. And that is the best reward which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has taken for us. And we need to gain that reward from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in order to be successful. Therefore, when we are Muslim and we need to follow Islam, this Islam itself is a matter of peace. It gives us peace in this world and in hereafter. Following Islam gives me inner peace in this world, in this material world where I am living, because I know that the actions that I'm performing, the help which I'm doing for the others, or the favors that I'm giving to others, the sacrifices that I'm making, these are not useless. There is a reward for it, and I will get that reward in hereafter. It will help me in my grave, and that's what Islam is all about. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Iran, as the prime victim of various sorts of terrorism by the U.S. and its proxies, has long endured with patience the assassination of its nationals and the damage to its economy in the hope that the hostile elements would come to their senses to remove tensions and the unnecessary shedding of blood. It, however, seems the enemies of humanity are harebrained and not willing to give up their crimes and acts of terrorism unless they are firmly dealt with. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading A Decisive Strike, Indeed. Stay tuned for more. There are no reports yet of the exact number of Zionists killed or wounded, but the missile barrage in the early hours of Sunday on an Israeli regime spying center in Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan, ought to make the enemies of humanity realize that the Islamic Republic of Iran is serious in its avowed vengeance for the innocent blood of martyrs. Terrorism, whether by the racist Zionist entity or by the CENTCOM terrorists, or for that matter by their agents, including Pejak traders and the macabrely murderous Takfiri outfits, should be rooted out in order to make the whole of West Asia stable and secure. Iran, as the prime victim of various sorts of terrorism by the U.S. and its proxies, has long endured with patience the assassination of its nationals and the damage to its economy, in the hope that the hostile elements would come to their senses to remove tensions and the unnecessary shedding of blood. It, however, seems the enemies of humanity are harebrained, not willing to give up their crimes and acts of terrorism unless they are firmly dealt with. The Erbil events are a clear warning in this regard and an indication that the next round of retaliation would be more devastating if the terrorists continue to target Iranian citizens and Iran's national interests in the region. Be sure, when Iran decides to act, it does it decisively and not in a half-hearted way. And there is no limit to reach of its vengeance when it deems the time has come. Of course, the Islamic Republic does not harm innocent people of any country, nor does it violate the territorial integrity and sovereignty of its neighbors while meting out the deserving punishment to the murderous culprits. This is fully evident in all its cross-border operations, including the latest one on the Israeli regime spying center in Erbil. Iran's missile barrage has been welcomed by the brotherly Iraqi nation and freedom-loving Kurdish people of Iraq, who detest being burdened by the unwanted presence in their towns and cities of the despicable Zionists, the hated Americans, and the traitorous Pejak. Tyranny is short-lived and justice finally prevails, thanks to human conscience that does not tolerate oppression of fellow humans. This means there are many conscientious persons in various parts of the world willing to be instruments of justice against terrorists without receiving any orders from Tehran. No amount of gadgets or security personnel can deter such conscientious persons who are capable of
piercing the protective cordon around the sensitive sites of the tyrannical regimes or the notorious murderers themselves. Recently, we heard a report that the U.S. is spending $2 million per month to keep the criminal called Mike Pompeo alive, and the amount for warding off the impending death away from the dastardly murderer, Donald Trump, might be many times more. The question is, would the squandering of the American taxpayers' hard-earned money for shielding terrorists from justice prolong the miserable life of the murderers of the Hammer of Terrorists, General Qasem Soleimani? Definitely not, since Iran's avowed vengeance has not yet materialized, and maybe the conscientious, justice-loving people of the U.S. will take their responsibility upon themselves to defang the devils, even in other parts of the world, unknown to the Islamic Republic and without any involvement on its part.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictive remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the U.S. Why is the U.S. hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories under Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You've still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that it can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted US-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was an almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Qassid carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense.